All right. Good morning. We are going to study today some of Parshas Beshalach. You can open up the Art School Stone Chumashim to page 381. It's right after Uz Yashir. I was a little bit frustrated when I started preparing this earlier this week because I was so certain that I'd prepared this once upon a time. I was very positive of it, and I couldn't find my notes, and I checked the recordings, you know, and I couldn't find it, and so I did it again. And while preparing, I read some things that further made me certain that I'd done this once before. I was like, yeah, right, I remember this. And it was a frustrating experience, but, you know, whatever. You didn't have to know that, but it's all good. So we're on page 380 in Art School Stone Chumashim. If you're not using the Art School, you're in Shemos Parak Tesvav Pasuk Chaf Beis. We're right after Uz Yashir. If you remember, the Jews they leave Egypt. They go through the sea. God splits the sea. The Egyptians drown. They come out the other side, and they sing this fantastic and wonderful spontaneous song. I've said in the past, and I still maintain that if I could go back to one day in Jewish history, you know, you ever think about that? Maybe not. Maybe I'm the weirdo. But if you could pick one moment in Jewish history to go back to, what would you like to see? Where would you go? Right? So I think that I might go back to Shiras Hayam. I might go back to Uz Yashir. You know, first you have the adrenaline, you know? The Egyptians are coming and you're stuck and you're scared, and then the sea splits and everybody runs through, and then you get out on the other side and the Egyptians drown, and then that spontaneous, you know, song that you know, I don't know, there's a couple of, you know, Matan Torah at Har Sinai. That's kind of scary for me. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm a little bit afraid of that. And so that's why maybe I pick Uz Yashir. But I don't know. Don't argue with me. I see a couple of faces. This is not worth the argument. Maybe at a different time. Are you really arguing with me right now? How do you choose? I don't know. I said one day. I said it was arbitrary. All right, so you pick 3 or 4 days. When you meet Doc and he shows you the what's that thing called? The triangle thing that, you know, what's that called? The super flex capacitor, that's it. And he takes you back in time. So then we'll decide. But until that DeLorean pulls up, we'll leave it at that. In any event, so we're on the other side. We sing the song, right? You can look at Pasuk Chaf, you know, 2 psukim before we're going to start, just to get us into the flow. Batikach Miriam Hanavia Achos Aaron Es Atofi Ada, and Miriam, she picks up drums with the ladies. Vateitzena Kol Anashim Acharel Besufim Mecholos, and all the ladies come out with drums and with dancing. Vatan Lahem Miriam Shiru Adonai Kigol. Right, the ladies singing, the men singing, beautiful, very, very nice. Like I said before, I'd love to have been there. And then the Torah tells us, right after, very next pasuk. Everybody here with me? Right? It's fantastic, right? Shira Sayam, we sang, everything was wonderful and lovely. And the very, very next verse, Vayasa Moshe es Yisrael miyam suf, vayetze el midbar shur. Moshe caused Israel to travel, and they went into the desert of Shur. Vayochu shloshes yamim bamidbar velo matzu mayim. They traveled 3 days in the desert, and they did not find water. It's a tremendous low after a tremendous high, right? You see it. The Jews are there and singing and happy, and everything is fantastic and wonderful, and then they have no water. They have absolutely nothing to drink, right? I'm just going to read through the psukim. We're only going to do 3 or 4 psukim today. Vayavohu Marasa, they reach this town called Mara. V'lo yachlu lishtos mayim mimara, they could not drink the water in Mara. Ki marim heim, so they had 3 days with no water. Finally, they reach this place that has water, and the water is not drinkable. Al kein karashim amara, that's why they called the name of the city Bitter, because the waters were bitter. They couldn't drink the water. Vayilonu ha'am al Moshe v'al Aaron, the people complained with Moshe and Aaron, Lamor Manishteh, saying, what are we going to drink? Vayitzak el Adonai, Moshe calls out to God. Vayoreu Adonai eats, God shows him a tree. Vayashlech el Amayim, he puts the tree into the water. Vayimtiku Amayim, and the waters become sweet. Sham sam lo choku mishpat v'sham nisahu. There God established for the nation decrees, ordinances, And there he tested them. Vayomer, and he said, Im shamoa tishma l'kol Adonai Elohecha, if you listen to God's voice, v'hayosher b'inav ta'aseh, and you do what is right in his eyes, v'ha'azanta l'mitzvosav, and you listen to his commands, v'shamarta kol chukav, and you guard all of his laws, kol amachala asher samti b'mitzrayim, lo asim alecha, ki Adoni, ani Adonai rofecha. All of the disease that I put against the Egyptians, I will not give to you, for I am the Lord your healer. Those are the psukim that we're going to learn today. This portion right after the splitting of the sea, right after this tremendous song. Turn back, everybody, to the beginning, to Pasuk Chaf Beis, verse 22. And let's, like we usually do, move through very, very slowly with the interpretations of the Rishonim and the Achronim and see what it is that perhaps we can learn from these psukim. These psukim are very rich, by the way. Very, very rich. It's only like four or five psukim. I don't even know if we'll finish it, though. There's a lot here. So the Torah tells us, Vayasa Moshe es Yisrael miyamsuf, and Moshe caused, Vayasa, it means that Moshe caused the Jewish people to journey. And the Rishonim were all troubled, because you don't find this phraseology anywhere else in the Torah. Right? The Torah often says, Vayisu, and they traveled. Right? But not Vayasa, that Moshe caused them to travel. So Rashi here, quoting from Medrash, Rashi here writes that Moshe had to push them. He had to push them. If you actually look in Medrash, I don't believe that Rashi says this, but if you look in the Medrash says with a stick. Moshe actually physically had to move the people. And why? Why? Why did he have to physically move the people? So Rashi, quoting Medrash, Rashi says, because when the Egyptians washed up on the shore, the Egyptians drowned in the sea, and then they washed up on the shore. And when the Egyptians washed up on the shore, washing up with them was a tremendous amount of riches. They had these chariots that were gold, and their armor, and a tremendous amount of riches. Right? Medrash says that the Bizas Hayam, the spoils from the sea, were greater than the spoils from Egypt. So when the Egyptians washed up on the sea, the Jews started to collect all of the riches, and they didn't want to leave. They didn't want to go. It was all of this wealth sitting there. And Moshe had to push them and get them to leave. It's fantastic. No, things don't change, right? The people knew. They knew that they were heading out into the desert, right? Ta'avdunis Elohim ala harazeh. They knew that they were going out into the desert to serve God on this mountain. They knew they were heading out to be near and close to God. And yet, they could not pull themselves away from the riches that were washing up on the side of the shores. The money for a very, very long time since the Jews left Egypt. What? Is that why I want to see the splitting of the sea? Thank you very much. That's very kind of you, right? But the allure of the, you know, I'm sorry about the noise. I can't do anything about it. The
Rabbi,
yes. What did I just say? Yeah.
Well, you know, they've just experienced this holy miracle thing, and now they want this holy experience unlike anything in history, so much that we all want to go back and actually witness it. And now they're succumbing to their most base material. It's just like a real...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. Well,
they just came from slavery.
Right.
It's
fascinating. There are two possibilities. One is, as we'll see, not all lines of interpretation speak so highly of the Jews right now. Right? Now, you have to remember, right? The Medrash already tells us that when the Jews got to the sea and God told the sea to split, the sea says no. The sea says no. Why? Medrash says, the sea said to God, what? Halalu ovdei avodah zarah, v'halalu ovdei avodah zarah. The Jews worship idols, the Egyptians worship idols. Why should I split for the Jews and kill the Egyptians? But the sea says no, right, to God. Now, okay, we have to understand that, Medrash, but the point that I'm trying to get at is, not everybody speaks so highly of the Jews right now, right? Yes, there was spontaneous song and praise of God. What was motivating that? There are two possibilities, right? One is a tremendous, you know, feeling of belief and connection. The other is, I got saved. That's incredible. Right? Now, those aren't necessarily the same. The second possibility, which you may like better, right? The second possibility is that there are different levels, and I'll suggest this again later on. There are different levels of belief. And what I mean by levels, I don't mean stronger and weaker. I mean in different circumstances. I mean, it's one thing to believe and be happy when God brings miracles and plagues and saves you from the hand of your oppressor. It's another thing to believe and walk away from a tremendous amount of money. That is not the same thing. Right? And it takes a stronger level of belief, if you will, right, to walk away from gold and riches and than it does to be happy when you're saved from a calamity. Does that make sense?
Yes.
What? That makes sense, right? We can all understand that. And that's what Rashi here writes, that Moshe had to push them and he had to hit them and he had to cause them to travel, because even though they knew, this is sad, but it's reality. Even though they knew that they were on their way to have this close encounter with God, they could not pry themselves away from the riches that were there on the side of the sea. It would be sad. It is sadder because it's the reality of the world in which we live in. It's sadder because things haven't changed all that much from the days that the Jews left Egypt thousands of years ago. Yeah.
But that's what we're supposed to be struggling with. We're supposed to be.
We are struggling with.
People, right?
Yes, we try. So they weren't there. They weren't there. It took some time. And we'll see as we learn some more of these psukim, that some of these events were intended to bring them to that level. That they didn't start there is not surprising. We have to work on ourselves until we get there. And we'll see some of these sources that the events that took place to the Jews were intended to bring them up to that level. Yeah. Right.
There's something. This isn't just like they reach this level. They reach a level that has not really been reached since.
Right. Ra'asa shivcha alayam ashalor ra'yechesko ben buzi b'chol
v'lasa. I would like to find a, or I hope you'll have an interpretation.
I do.
Give them just a little bit more.
I do. I do, in fact. Perhaps you will like Rabbi Hirsch's interpretation better. Rabbi Hirsch says that, yes, Moshe had to cause them to leave. They didn't want to leave. Why did they want to stay there? Not because they were collecting money, like Rashi says. That's not it. You know what Rabbi Hirsch writes? You know what they just went through? They just went through perhaps one of the closest encounters that people have ever had with God. They saw the protection of God so clearly. Chazal tell us that a maidservant at the sea saw more than Yechezkel, than the prophet Yechezkel. And they said to Moshe, what are you, crazy? We're not leaving here. We're going to live right here, in this place, where God protected us and He sheltered us and He saved us and we saw Him so clearly and so openly and so obviously. This is where we'll stay. Rabbi Hirsch says, they didn't want to leave. They didn't want to leave. They felt such a close connection to that place that they wanted to set camp right there. They didn't want to go. They didn't want to go. But Moshe caused them to leave. You know, it's interesting. I think if Rabbi Hirsch is correct, then we learn something else that's instructive. Not like Rashi and money and all, we don't have to talk about that. Right? Where Rabbi Hirsch's understanding is correct, then we see something else. You see, Moshe caused them to leave, but why? The people were right. They had such a strong connection to that place. They felt so near and close to God in that place. You see, sometimes we don't realize that we can do better. Isn't that interesting? Moshe had to tell them, no, there's more. They didn't see that. They didn't realize. They thought they were there. They thought this was it. We have seen God so close and so near. And Moshe had to tell them, no, there's more. There's more. It can be better. Let's keep going. See, sometimes I think we feel like the Jewish people felt back then. Sometimes I think that we look around and we feel like we're there. This is it. We are fantastic. We are great. And sometimes we need Moshe Rabbeinu to come and tell us there's more. It can be better. This is great. This doesn't mean this is bad. It doesn't mean this is bad. This is great. But it could be better. There's more. We can get closer. We can get nearer. There's Har Sinai, which is just 6 days away. We need to push forward. We need to move on. And sometimes we get stubborn. Sometimes we like the Jewish people. We think that what we're doing is the best. We think, no, right here. We should stay right here, right now. We don't want to go. We get stubborn. We don't want to move on. And sometimes we need somebody to push us physically, to move past, to realize that it could be better, that we should not just sit where we are, but that there could be more. Where we are is great. Where the Jewish people were was fantastic. They said this close encounter with God, they'd done a tremendous amount. But it could be more. It could be better. Sometimes I think we fall into that trap too. Right? We look at our accomplishments and we say, look at what we've done. Let's park it right here. And sometimes we need that Moshe Rabbeinu to be able to come and say, no, yeah, this is great. But it could be more. It could be better. Let's keep going. Don't stay here. And sometimes we get stubborn. And sometimes we need to be pushed. Sometimes we need to be pushed forward, right? It's very, very different, but I think that that's also very, very important, and I think that that's also very, very true. Michilta writes very, very different things. Michilta is a medrash, comes from the Tanoim, and you find the machlokes Tanoim here that's very, very interesting. A machlokes between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. A machlokes between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Yeshua says that if you look throughout all of the travels that the Jews do throughout the desert, Rabbi Yeshua says that all of the travels they do throughout the desert were al pi Hashem. God told them, travel, right? There was the cloud, and the cloud traveled, and all the travels. The Torah tells us, "Api Hashem Yiso, Api Hashem Yachanu, Api Hashem Yiso," that the Jews encamped by the word of God, they traveled by the word of God, except for this one. This travel is not by the word of God. This travel is by the word of Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbi Yeshua writes that this traveling on the other side of the sea is the praise of Moshe Rabbeinu. That Moshe Rabbeinu didn't wait. Moshe Rabbeinu took initiative. And Moshe Rabbeinu, they got out on the other side of the sea and the Jews were looking around and they didn't know where to go and they weren't sure what to do. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, let's go. Let's go. Vayisa Moshe. Moshe caused them to travel. Quickly, let's go, let's move, let's not wait, let's not delay. The praise of Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu did not wait. He picked up and he traveled and he pushed the people. Moshe Rabbeinu took initiative to start moving and to start going. I don't have to talk about initiative. I do enough about that on Shabbos. That's Rabbi Yeshua's opinion in the Michilta. Rabbi Eliezer writes a very, very different opinion. Very similar, but very, very different. Rabbi Eliezer writes that this is not praise of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is praise of the Jewish people. That the Torah is telling us, contrary to Rashi's interpretation and Rabbi Hirsch's interpretation, but as soon as Moshe Rabbeinu said, let's go, the Jewish people picked up and they went. It was as if Moshe Rabbeinu was pushing them. He wasn't actually pushing them. He said, all right, guys, let's go. And as soon as he said, let's go, they picked up and they went. Very, very different than Rashi and Rabbi Hirsch. Almost opposite, right? Rashi and Rabbi Hirsch write that they wanted to stay there. Why'd they want to stay there? Rashi says money. Rabbi Hirsch says divine connection. But they wanted to stay. They didn't want to leave, right? Rabbi Eliezer in the Medrash Mechilta writes, it's almost the opposite. That as soon as Moshe said, let's go, it was as if he was pushing them. They just got up and they started running. So much so was their belief in God at that moment that the people didn't look at Moshe Rabbeinu and say to him, what are you, crazy? Going to the desert with no water and with limited food? Whoa, what are you, nuts? They didn't complain. They didn't say anything at that moment. We'll see if this line of interpretation is correct. It didn't last very long, right? But at that moment, they had such tremendous belief in God, that as soon as Moshe said, let's go, they picked up and they traveled. They didn't think, they didn't plan, they didn't worry, nothing. Up and gone. Right? That's Rabbi Eliezer's interpretation. That Moshe, he didn't physically push them. It was as if he was pushing them. He said, let's go, and they up and went. There's another interpretation in Michilta, and this one does not speak so glowingly of the Jewish people. But another interpretation of in the Medrash Michilta also writes that Moshe had to push them to go. You know why Moshe had to push them to go? You know what they wanted to do? Go back. They saw all the Egyptians lying there dead, and you know what they said? The place is empty. What are we going to go set up our own country and deal with people who are living there and set up our own, build home? Let's just go back. We'll take over. We'll be in charge. Done. Easy. Let's go back. So Moshe had to stop them. Vayasa, Moshe Sa'am. No, stop. Let's go this way. So I'm just pointing out, you find different levels of interpretation. It's very, very clear, right, that even the Tanoim in the Medrash, certainly the Rishonim, were uncertain. What was the standing of the Jewish people at this moment? What was their makeup? What was their mentality? Where were they? You have levels of interpretation that assume that they were so much so believing in God that they didn't even care. Go into the desert. Yeah! Let's go! Right? And you have levels of interpretation that said, well, okay, that was fantastic. That was wonderful. Now let's go back. Right? Or wait, 1 second, God. 1 second. Just let me pick up this coin. God, I'm coming, but there's a diamond here. Are you serious? I mean, come on. Right? You have levels of interpretation on both sides. And I'm not picking and choosing. This has always been my attitude, and I hope that I've imparted this a little bit in these classes, that for us, I think that they're all correct. Meaning that for us, there's something that we can learn from each of these levels of interpretation. Each of them are instructive. Now, if we wanted to, we can look at the text and try to pick which of the levels of interpretation we believe to be more accurate. Which of the levels of interpretation speak more to us? Which do I like better? But I think that it's important for us to see them all because I think they're all instructive. I think that we learn from each of the levels of interpretation, even if they all can't be correct at the exact same time. Does that make sense? I hope so. Yeah, Eileen. Good, really good question. So if you look at Ibn Ezra on this pasuk, and I purposefully left it out because it's a little bit complicated and I really didn't want to talk so much about the cloud. But Ibn Ezra here has a conversation about when did the cloud come and what did the cloud look like and how many clouds were there. And he has a whole conversation over there. Ibn Ezra believes there was only one cloud and it came here. And when the pasuk says that Moshe caused them, it doesn't really mean that Moshe. Of course it was the cloud. And that's Ibn Ezra's interpretation. And he argues with others who say that there were seven clouds and clouds were surrounding them on all sides, right? Obviously, if you remember on Sukkot, there's a debate whether it was clouds or real Sukkot. Ibn Ezra thinks there was no way it was clouds. It's not possible. That's Ibn Ezra's opinion, but then Ibn Ezra writes, and this is classic. Ibn Ezra says he, v'im kabalahi nikabel, but if that's really the tradition, that so then I accept it. He writes that I don't think it's right and I don't think it's possible and this is what I think, but if that's the tradition, then I accept it. That the intellectual honesty of Ibn Ezra is very, very nice to see. But it is it could be that it was here already. That's Ibn Ezra's interpretation. Others thought that it came after, once they began traveling. But in any event, let's keep going. Right. So I don't mean going to the next pasuk. Obviously, I'm not done with this one yet. But let's keep moving is what I mean. Right. So Vayelchu Shloshes Yamim Bamidbar Velo Matzu Mayim. So they traveled 3 days and they didn't find water. Rabbeinu Chananel, in his interpretation on these psukim, says that they didn't actually travel 3 days without water. Because had they traveled 3 days without water, many of them most probably would have died. Right? I don't remember from like third or fourth grade science how long you could live without water, and I didn't look it up. Right? I don't remember. Did anybody know offhand? What? How long can you live without water? 3 days? A week? Longer? I don't know how long it is. It's not so important to me, right, at this current moment. All right, I'm sorry that I asked. But Rabbeinu Chananel writes that they didn't actually travel 3 days without water. Rabbeinu Chananel says that they traveled a 3 day distance. They traveled it in 1 day. So they went 1 day without water. That's Rabbeinu Chananel's interpretation, right? If you look in Medrash Mechilta, I believe it's also Gemara and Bava Kama, the Gemara and Medrash, they both write that this is an analogy. Vayochu Shloshes Yamim Bamidbar Velo Matzu Mayim, they went 3 days without water. Medrash says that they went 3 days without studying Torah. Torah is often compared to water. Why that is not our topic right now, but Torah is often compared to water, and Medrash says they went 3 days without studying Torah. And since they went 3 days without studying Torah, they became wary. It was as if they didn't have water, right? They became wary. It's interesting, by the way, the Gemara writes that this is why Moshe Rabbeinu instituted that we lean from the Torah on Shabbos, Monday, and Thursday. We lean from the Torah during our morning prayers on Shabbos, Monday, and Thursday. Why do we do that? So the Gemara writes, we read from the Torah publicly, right, on Shabbos, Monday, and Thursday. And the Gemara writes that the reason why we do that is because of this this pasuk. It comes from this pasuk in the Torah. They went 3 days without studying Torah. We'd never want to go 3 days without studying Torah. So we read publicly from the Torah on Shabbos, Monday, and Thursday to assure that we'll never go 3 days without studying Torah. It's very, very interesting, by the way. It means then, Rabbi Soloveitchik Rabbi Schechter in his book Nefesh HaRav, quoting from Rabbi Soloveitchik, writes that if this is correct, then our public reading of the Torah is a different obligation than, for instance, our public reading of Megillas Esther. Right? The purpose and function of reading from the Torah is to make sure that we have public learning. Right? That's what the Medrash and the Gemara write. To make sure we have public learning. As opposed to our reading of Megillas Esther, which is an individual obligation. Meaning the public reading of the Torah is an obligation on the congregation to make sure that there's learning, that you don't go 3 days without Torah. But it is not an obligation on each individual. I'll give you an example just to make this divide clearer. Right? Let's say you don't make it to shul on Purim, you know, night or Purim day, whichever one, right? Do you have to hear Megillah? Absolutely, right? You have to have somebody come to you and they read for you Megillah, right? I'll do that for you if you want, by the way. I'm not promising, but if you need help, we'll set it up for you. Right, I'm not saying I will come. I mean, I'm capable, but I'm not offering. I'm saying that, you know, we'll set it up for you should you need it. Right, but you need to hear Megillah. If you can't come to shul, you need to have somebody come and read it for you. Right, everybody's with me. What happens if I can't make it to shul Shabbos morning? So I miss a leaning. Do I have to have somebody come read the Torah for me? Why not? What's the difference? So Rabbi Soloveitchik says the difference is that the obligation of Megillah is an individual obligation. I have an obligation to hear the Megillah, to remember the events that happened, whatever have you. But the reading of the Torah is not an individual obligation. It's a communal obligation to make sure that there's learning going on in our community. To make sure that there's learning going on, that we don't go 3 days without having learning. So it's not an obligation on each individual to hear the leaning. It's an obligation on the congregation to set up the learning. Is that clear? Yeah? Everybody's with me? That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik writes. It all comes from this pasuk. That they went 3 days without water. The Talmud and the Medrash write, it wasn't really water. They went 3 days without studying Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu saw what happens if you go 3 days without studying Torah. So Moshe Rabbeinu set up that we read Torah on Shabbos, on Monday, and on Thursday. That's what the Gemara says.
The question is that they really
weren't learning Torah. Oh, it's a good question. Kliyakar asks this question. He gives a beautiful answer, which I wasn't planning on sharing with you. What?
Maybe they went 3 days without seeing a miracle.
No. Kliyakar asks this question, right? Kliyakar says, right, what Abby just asked me. They didn't have the Torah. So what does that mean? They went 3 days without studying Torah. They hadn't received it yet. What are you talking about, right? Kliyakar asks this question. You know what he answers? Right, Rabbi Shlomo Ephraim Lunshitz, Kliyakar, right? When the Maharal died in Prague, Kliyakar was his successor, right? Right, he was originally named Ephraim when his parents called him Ephraim Lunshitz. That was his name. He got very, very sick at age 20, so they changed his name. They added the name Shlomo, complete, whole. It worked. He got better. Right, we do that. That's one of the things that we do. Right, it worked. He got better. I think he lived another. I was about to say 30, but then I'm not sure if it's 50. I think another 50 years. I think he died around 70 years old. I should research that. I'm sorry. I don't remember. We'll look that up. Google it. Kliyakar, Rabbi Shlomo Ephraim Lunshitz. It'll come up. You'll find it. This is easy to find out. Right? So he took over for the Maharal in Prague. So Kliyakar, he asks this question. They didn't have Torah. So what does that mean? They went 3 days without Torah. So you know what he says? He picks up on Rashi and Rabbi Hirsch's interpretations that the Jews delayed on the Yom Suf. They dallied. He says, you know what they should have done after the Yom Suf? They should have ran. They should have ran to Har Sinai. They should have ran to go get the Torah, but they didn't. They delayed. They dallied. They waited. And in that delay, they wouldn't have had the gold, okay? So they wouldn't have had the gold. Good. Good. So they wouldn't have had the gold. They would have figured it out. I don't know what would have happened. So they wouldn't have had the gold. You know, listen, you know, I'm not picking on you right now. I'm really, really not. I am not picking on you right now, right? But listen, I don't have time to learn. Who has time to learn? I got to do this, and I got to make this bucks, and that bucks, and these bucks, and I need more bucks, and I, you know, I'm not preaching. I'm not. But, right? But, so that's what Kliyaka writes. They should have ran to Har Sinai, and they didn't. They didn't. So it was as if, yeah, they didn't have the Torah, but they should have ran. They should have taken off to get there, and they didn't do that. They didn't do that. And so it was as if they went 3 days without studying Torah. That's what Kliyaka writes. I think that's nice. That works for me. It doesn't have to work for you, but that works for me. That's what Kliyaka says. Okay, fantastic. So this is where we have the obligation for Kriyas HaTorah, for reading the Torah. This is where it comes from. Finally, Malbim writes that he believes that this no water, this spell without water, was purposeful. God didn't do this by accident. God didn't do by accident that the Jews wouldn't have water. Malbim writes that this was a test. This was a beginning of a test of the Jewish people to show them that they are constantly and always in need of Hashgachas Hashem, of God's watching out, of God's providence. In preparation for receiving the Torah, Malbim writes, the Jewish people had to learn, they had to know that Srichim b'chol rega l'hashgachas Hashem, that you need at every instant the divine providence. And God, therefore, at the end of seeing all of these miracles and the plagues and the splitting of the sea and everything like that, God wanted to show the Jewish people what would happen if he pulled back. So they went into the desert and there was no miracle. There was no water. They were left there with nothing. God wanted to show and demonstrate, Malbim believes, that in preparation of receiving of the Torah, the Jewish people had to learn that at every moment, they require divine providence. That's Malbim's interpretation. Finally, we're up to the next pasuk. And the Torah tells us, Vayavau Marasa. They reached this town called Mara. V'lo yachlu lishtos mayim mimara ki marim heim. And they couldn't drink the water from Mara because they were bitter. Al-kein karashim ha-Mara. So they called the name of the town Mara. Malbim finds it interesting that they called the name of the town Mara bitter because they couldn't drink the water. So Malbim believes that the water was really good water. It was good water. And when they got there, something happened. God made the water bitter. And that's why they changed the name of the city. They called it Mara because of the miracle that happened there, the bad miracle that happened there, that God made the water bitter. Okay, take it or leave it. In any event, right, what happened next is very, very fascinating. Oh, when I was preparing, I loved this. Vayilonu ha'am al Moshe v'al Moshe. The people complained to Moshe le'mor manishteh, saying, what should we drink? Right? And Mechilta, Medrash Mechilta here writes something so fantastic. There's something wrong about the grammar in this sentence. Somebody help me here. If you wanted to say that the people complained to Moshe, what would you say? Vayulonu ha'am? El Moshe! They complained to Moshe, but that's not what the Pasuk says. What does the Pasuk say? They complained al Moshe. What does that mean? About Moshe. You know what the Medrash writes? This is so fantastic. Rabbi Yeshua and Medrash Mechilta writes that the Jewish people here did something wrong. Rabbi Yeshua writes, when you have a problem with somebody, when you have a problem, what should you do? What should you do? You should go to them. And you should talk to them, but that's not what the Jewish people did. They didn't complain to Moshe. They complained about Moshe. Vayulonu ha'am al Moshe. Who did they go to? They went to their neighbor. They went to the person across the street. They went to somebody else. What?
Beginning of Lashon Hara.
Oh, you're right. This is so true. That's why I loved this so much. When we have problems with people, sometimes it's uncomfortable to confront them. I don't want to confront. So what do I do instead? I start talking to somebody else. You want to hear what happened? You want to hear what this guy did? You believe this? You believe that this guy? Is that incredible? Right? We complain about them. We don't complain to them. We complain about them. We get upset. Vayilonu ha'am al Moshe. They complained about Moshe. It gets better. It gets better. Rabbi Hirsch writes, what's the root word of Vayilonu? This is so fantastic. What's the root word of Vayilonu? It's lun. Lun is the same root word as the word lina. What does lina mean? Lina means to stay over, to sleep over, like a temporary shelter. a temporary place where you encamp, is a lina, a temporary dwelling, right? Rabbi Hirsch writes, the word vayilonu, they complained on Moshe, you know what they did? They built for themselves shelter, protection. You know why we complain to other people? Because that's comforting. It gives us shelter. It gives us protection. It comforts us. Listen, we're not wrong. We didn't do anything. That guy is terrible, and I'm going to get other people on my side. I'm going to get support. I'm going to get shelter. I'm not going to confront that person and talk and work out my issues. Heaven forbid. No. I'm going to talk to somebody else and make rumors and complain about the person so that other people will get on my side and I'll have protection and then I'll win. That's what Medrash writes, combined with Rabbi Hirsch. I'm combining it artificially, but I think that it works. And it's so, so true. And Medrash writes, Rabbi Yeshua says in Medrash Mechilta that this was an error that the Jewish people did. This was a mistake. They should not have done that. Right? We'll see in a minute. We'll see in a minute. Ibn Ezra writes that this was part of a test, but we'll see it in a second. We'll get there. I don't want to jump the gun. But Medrash writes that when we have problems, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to talk to people. They should have come to Moshe. They should have spoken to him. If they had problems with Moshe, they should have spoken to Moshe. If they had complaints against God, what did you bring us here and no water? They should have spoken to God. But that's not what they did. That's not what they did. And we can't do that either. We can't do that either. It's sad because we do that. Because we know people who do that. And it's unfortunate. And it causes fighting and machlokes and argument. But that's why we learn Chumash. Because it instructs us about life. And it tells us what to do. Right? When we have problems, we don't whisper and murmur and start rumors and complain and get people on our side and make support. And no. When we have problems, we deal with people. I remember, maybe I shouldn't do this. But I remember one time... You can't make up life. Sometimes it's unfortunate. But I remember one time I said something that offended somebody else. I remember. I said something, and I still to this day maintain that it wasn't all that offensive. I still think that it wasn't all that offensive. Now, obviously, I'm going to say that, so you don't have to believe me. So let's pretend even that it was heinously offensive, something that I said, right? And I remember that the fellow walked out. And every time I got up to speak thereafter, he continued to walk out. And he never spoke to me about it, right? He never spoke to me about it. And there was one time where I tried to speak to him about it. It was so hurtful. It was. I felt bad. I did. But sometimes we just react in ways that are not normal, right? And that's what here Medrash tells us. Medrash tells us when you have a problem, you... talk to people. You don't complain to somebody else. You don't try to get other people on your side. You talk to people. You work things out. Vayulonu ha'am al Moshe should not have been. Vayulonu ha'am el Moshe, maybe. Complain to Moshe, but not about Moshe. That's not how we react. That's not how we do things. That's what Medrash says. Malbim writes something different. Malbim says they shouldn't have complained to Moshe. Malbim says that they should have davened. They should have davened. Malbim says that this was a sign. Right? You don't have to like this. But Malbim says that this was a sign. When there was no water and the Jewish people started complaining, it was a sign. Malbim says, Shelo haya levavam shalem, that their belief was not whole. It was not complete. Because they didn't daven, they started to complain. You know, I think, like I said before, that this does not mean that we have to assume that the whole time they were lacking in belief. I think that there, like I said before, that there is a difference between believing in God when everything is great and believing in God when you go 3 days without any water to drink. I think that there's a divide there. And it requires a building up of belief in God and a stronger belief in God. Right? You know, the Musar Svarim will tell you that being rich and being poor are the same test. That's what the Musar Svarim will tell you. Right? They will tell you that if you're poor, it's a challenge because you have to, you know, have belief when you're poor. And they'll tell you that if you're rich, it's the same challenge because you have to deal with your money properly and you have to use it properly and it's different tests. And while I believe that that's true to a certain extent, it does not mean that all tests are equal. While everything is a test, it does not mean that all tests are equal. You can disagree with that, but I think that's true. Do I have agreement or disagreement on that? Because it's not so simple what I just said. It's not so simple, right? And I think that some of the Musar books would not agree. I think that they would in fact argue. But I don't know. I think that from life experience, while I agree that everything is a test, that does not mean that all tests are equal. That's my belief. Yes.
Just as the greater the person, the more responsibility they have. I think depending on who who we are and what God gives us to work with in our lives, that's how we're tested accordingly. Also.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all true.
I mean, how many of us would have been in Abraham and actually
I don't know.
Put our children up to be? I mean, talk about
I don't know.
Test.
I don't know.
Who of us could have passed that test?
All right, listen. We also have tests, especially about raising children. We also have tests, right? What are our tests are very different. Our tests are very different, right? What do we show our kids? Okay, so we don't have to deal with idolaters. We have to deal with, I'm not going to finish that sentence, with other things. We have to deal with other things. That was very strong of me. Please, right? I'm not usually that good. But okay, I am very pleased right now. What? Good. Right. I'm not trying to be arrogant right now. I'm seeing self-improvement in myself. The filter is working better. I'm working on it. Okay, good. Excellent. Right? I'm going to get complaints right now about that. People are going to be upset. Why didn't you finish the sentence? And I'm like, all right, listen. Whatever. So let's keep going. So they complain to Moshe and they say, what should we drink? Vayitzak el Adonai. Moshe calls out to God. You know what? Medrash Mechilta here writes something so fantastic. Medrash Mechilta writes, let's remember what happened, right? What did the Jewish people just do? They complain. What do they complain? About Moshe, they don't even complain to Moshe. They make rumors about him. They say, and what does Moshe do in the very next pasuk? He davens for them. Medrash writes that tzaddikim are very quick to forgive. We're not always so quick to forgive, right? Sometimes people harm us and we get upset, and sometimes we hold a grudge, and sometimes it takes a long time until we'll even look at people or speak to people, let alone do nice things for them. And Medrash here writes that Moshe Rabbeinu not only does he forgive, but he davens. He prays for the Jewish people in the very next verse, right after they complain about him. What?
He knew who he was dealing with.
He knew he was dealing with. That could be. That could be. But it's very instructive, right? Moshe Rabbeinu is quick to forgive. And he davens for the people. He davens for them. Tzaddikim don't hold a grudge. The tzaddikim don't hold a grudge. That's what Medrash here writes. Now, Moshe davens. Vayareu Adonai eats. God shows him a tree. Vayashleich el amayim. Vayim teku amayim. And he puts the tree in the water, and the waters get sweet. So Medrash here writes, some of the other Rishonim quote it, that this is an added miracle, right? If you're cooking something at home and it's a little bitter, what do you put into it?
Sugar.
You put in something sweet, right?
Not trees.
Not something bitter like that, right? So Medrash here writes that this was an added miracle, that Moshe put in something like tree, right? And it sweetened the water. That in and of itself was an added miracle. I believe, by the way, that this is why the pharmaceutical companies try to make the medicine as bad tasting as possible. They attempt to emulate God. When you have something that's not working properly and you want to fix it, so you have to use something bad. If you used something good, that would be too easy. Okay, fine, that's a joke. But it makes sense, right? Okay, very good. In any event, so the Medrash writes, and the Rishonim here try to pick up on that, right? The Rishonim do pick up on it, that there was an added miracle, that Moshe added something bad, tree, into the water, and all of a sudden the water got sweet. But then the Pasuk says, Sham sam lo choku mishpat visham nisahu. Direct translation, there he established for the nation a decree and an ordinance, and there he tested it. Right? So what did he give them and what was the test? What did God give them and what was the test? So you find interesting interpretations in the Rishonim. Ibn Ezra writes, like I think I foreshadowed before, that here God taught them a lesson. The lesson that God taught them is that you need to believe in God in bad times as well. Right? That's what Ibn Ezra writes. Ibn Ezra says that the test was to see if they would complain or if they would daven. That's what Ibn Ezra writes, right? Like we've been talking about before, that it's great that they believed and they sang praise when everything was great and there were miracles and salvation, but when there's no water, what will you do? What will you do? That was the test. That's what Ibn Ezra says. Visham nisahu, there God tested them. And what did God give them? We'll read it in a second, right? We'll read it in a second, what God gave them. But that's Ibn Ezra's interpretation. I want to read to you from Rabbi Hirsch. Right? This is great. I'm going to read you direct. Rabbi Hirsch writes, are you ready? Oh, please. Yes, please. Go ahead.
The testing is only after Yetzias Mitzrayim, because when all of
yes.
the tribes are
That's not what Ibn Ezra says. But let me read. You might like this, okay? Rabbi Hirsch writes, that's not Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra's opinion is like we just said, right? But Rabbi Hirsch writes something different. You might like this better. Why do you usually like the second thing I say? Why can't I say the thing you like first, and then you'll be happy? Right? I don't know. Right? But look what Rabbi Hirsch writes. Or listen, sorry, I should say, to what Rabbi Hirsch says. Oh. Quote, "The salvation from Egypt and the passage through the sea had taught for all time that God was extraordinarily near at moments of extraordinary danger and crisis, but that he could be depended on for the ordinary requirements of everyday life in all circumstances, that the so-called little daily necessities of man are not too small and petty for the divine eye to see and for the divine hand to provide, that one who is faithful to God with every breath he draws can confidently rely on the constant presence of his, capital H, of God's help. That is what the journey through the wilderness was to teach." Should I read that again, or does that all make sense? Right? Let me read. Well, it wasn't supposed to. It wasn't supposed to. Let me read on. "This Torah that wants every second of our daily life to be spent in the service of God requires as an essential trait confidence in God. It requires complete confidence in the constant presence of God, ever ready to help, and in the knowledge that carrying out His, capital H, God's will, as expressed in the Torah, has the power to guide us safely and happily through the most desolate deserts of life, to sweeten for us the bitterest droughts that life can offer. To induce such confidence was the preparatory work which was to be accomplished in the wilderness for the acceptance of the divine Torah. This first experience was to be gained at Marah. For 3 days they had found no water. The water which they did finally find was bitter. Thereupon God taught Moses of a tree. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet and drinkable. There, in face of this experience, of seeing how the bitterest becomes sweet by that which God teaches us to combine with it, there God gave them the fundamentals of law and justice, and made them look upon His law and His justice as the remedy for all physical and social ills, inasmuch as He proclaimed Himself thereby their doctor, Ki ani Adonai Rofecha." It's beautiful, isn't it? I think it's beautiful. That's what Rabbi Hirsch says, that the Jewish people were to learn through this stay in the desert that God not only performs miracles in times of danger, that God is not only there when things are bad, but that God is relied upon and counted upon at every moment to provide us with the smallest necessities, with water to drink, with food to eat, not only with the splitting of the sea and the salvation from Egypt, but with food and water, everything that happens. It's beautiful, Rabbi Hirsch writes, right? That the little daily necessities of man are not too small and petty for the divine eye to see and for the divine hand to provide. It's gorgeous. We don't write like that anymore. He didn't write like that either. You wrote it in German. I know. Give me a break. It's beautiful. That's what Rabbi Hirsch writes. Right? Rashi writes something different. Rashi writes that what God gave them, shamsam lo choku mishpat, not like Ibn Ezra, not like Rabbi Hirsch, that God gave them, I shouldn't say not like Rabbi Hirsch, because later on Rabbi Hirsch writes this too, but not that God gave them a fundamental, but that God gave them actual law. Rashi writes that God gave them at Marah mitzvos, certain mitzvos. He taught them at Marah about Shabbos. He taught them at Marah about Parah Aduma. He taught them at Marah about Jewish courts. That's what Rashi says, right? That God taught them actual law. Sephorno writes that was the test. Sephorno writes, not like Ibn Ezra. The test was not to see if they would complain. The test was to see how they would react to the laws that God was beginning to present to them. Ramban writes that God gave them laws at Marah, that God gave them here laws to ease them into it. It's not easy to accept all of the laws of the Torah at one time. It's not easy to accept the whole Torah at once. God tried to ease them into it a little bit. He gave them a few laws at Marah, a little bit. Let's get used to it. Let's see how it goes. I don't know what would have happened if it would have gone poorly. Ramban doesn't say. I don't know. But Ramban says, let's take a few, a little bit at Marah. Ease the Jewish people into it. That's Rashi, Ramban, Sephorno, they all write that the test was to see how they would react to receiving some of the mitzvos, to see how it would go. Ramban thinks to ease them into it, to give them a little bit of a taste. Yeah, question.
What does it say when the mitzvahs are?
Medrash writes, Rashi here writes that the mitzvahs were Shabbos, Para Aduma, Dinim. I believe that. They had it before even. Here they got Shabbos. And Mara, this is before. This is beforehand. They already had Shabbos at that point, right? Right? That's what Medrashi writes. That's what Rashi here quotes. There's others listed, right? I believe that Kibbut Av HaEim is listed somewhere as being given at Mara. There's different lists of which mitzvahs were given at Mara. But certainly some mitzvahs were given at Mara. And then the Torah says, Vayomer, and he said, Im Shamoa Tishma Lekol Adonai Elohecha, if you will listen to God, Vahayasha Be'ein Avtaseh, and you do that which is straight in his eyes, Vahazanta Lemitzvosav, you listen to his commands, Vishamarta Chokuchav, and you guard all of his teachings, Kola Machala Asher Samti Mimitzayim Lo Asim Alecha, Ki Anuni Arofecha, all of the plagues that I brought in Egypt, I will not bring against you, for I am God, your healer. And the Rishonim here have different interpretations. What are all of these things, right? If you listen to God's voice and you do what is good and straight in His eyes and you listen to His commands and you guard all of His teaching, these are not all the same thing, right? This is not just poetic and repetitive, right? So the Rishonim all have different interpretations. They're all very similar but moderately different, right? Rashi writes, right? You find this Rashi in a couple of places. Vishamarta chok chukav, right? What's a chok? What's a chok? A chok is something you don't understand. I don't understand. It doesn't make sense. And why am I doing this? And it doesn't make any sense. And right, that's a chok. Right, that's a chok. And so Rashi says that what it's being added at that point is that we have to accept all of the mitzvot. That's what the pasuk says. If you want God to be our provider and our healer and watch out for us, it requires us to be all in. Right, it requires us to accept all of the mitzvos, everything, even the ones we don't understand and don't make sense. And why are we doing it? And we have to accept everything. That's what Rashi says. Rashbam believes that this is the lesson. This is what were they supposed to learn? Ibn Ezra should interpret like this too, right? That God tested them. What were they supposed to learn? They were supposed to learn, if you listen to God's commands and you follow everything that God says and everything that He tells us to do, then all the plagues that God teaches, that all the plagues that God brings, it won't come upon us, right? Ramban writes, Ki ani Hashem Rofecha, I am God your healer. Ramban says He will be an actual healer. An actual healer. We won't need doctors. We should go to doctors, by the way, right? Right? We should go to doctors. Ramban himself was a doctor, right? But Ramban writes that in that perfect world, which we are not living in right now, in that perfect world where we keep all of God's commands and God will watch out for us and we won't need them. We won't need them. We don't have any doctors in the room, right? Okay, good. Right? We won't need them. Right? We do right now. We should go to doctors. I'm not saying anything crazy. Right, but in that perfect world, maybe one day we'll get there. I hope so. Right, we won't need them. But that's what Ramban here writes. Right, Ibn Ezra here writes something very, very interesting. Ibn Ezra writes that im shamoa tishma lekol Hashem Elokecha, if you will listen to God's voice. Ibn Ezra writes here that this shamoa tishma lekol, this Hebrew conjugation, the way that this sentence is structured, this listening doesn't mean listen. Doesn't mean listen. It means understand. Ibn Ezra writes that what the pasuk is saying is not if you listen to God's commands, but if you understand what you're doing. It's very, very interesting, right? There's a machlokus in the Gemara in Brachos. Brachos. Final answer. There's a machlokus in the Gemara in Brachos. Right? You would have trusted me. I could have said anything. Yeah, right, right. There's a machlokus in the Gemara in Brachos. We there's a pasuk in the Torah, right? A famous one. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Right? What does the word Shema mean? There's a machlokus in the Gemara in Brachos. What the word Shema means? You didn't know this? There's a Gemara and there's an argument. What does the word Shema mean? One opinion in the Gemara says that the word Shema means hear. Here. There's halachic ramifications, by the way, to this machlokus. And therefore, the Gemara continues, if the word means here, when I say the Shema, I need to say it audibly. When I say Shema, I need to say it audibly. Why? Because that's what it says. Shema, here, listen. So I need to say it audibly. But there's a second opinion in the Gemara. The second opinion says that the word Shema doesn't mean hear, doesn't mean listen. The word Shema means understand. Which is why the Gemara writes, according to the second opinion, I don't have to say it audibly necessarily, but I do have to understand it. Which means the second opinion writes that if I don't understand Hebrew, then I should say Shema in whatever language I understand. This is an argument in the Gemara, and I don't want to talk halacha now. How we paskin and how I should do it, I don't want to talk halacha now. What I want to point out is sometimes, right, and you can even say this in English, right? If I say in English, I hear you, that could mean two things, right? It could mean I physically, you're audible to me, I hear you. But it could also connote a deeper cognitive process. I hear you, meaning I understand you. Right? In English, it's true also. The word hear doesn't only mean hear, it could also mean understand. And that's what Ibn Ezra here writes, that when it comes to the mitzvahs, we're not just supposed to do the mitzvahs. That's not what God intends. Right? I might get in trouble, I don't mean to say anything controversial right now, but monkeys can do mitzvahs too. Right? Right? Rabbi Schechter once said something like that, and people got all insulted. Oh, he's calling us monkeys. Right? People got all upset. People are looking to create fights. I don't know. That's what it comes down to, right? But monkeys can perform actions too, right? God asks us not just to do mitzvahs, but to understand mitzvahs, to have them affect us, to know what it is that we're doing. By the way, of course, that involves education, right? If I am going to understand the mitzvah, it means I have to know what the mitzvah is about. If I don't know what it's about, I can't possibly have any understanding in it. But okay, fine. But that's what Ibn Ezra here writes, that added onto the performance of the mitzvah is also understanding of the mitzvah. Ramban here writes something else, and we'll try to wrap things up. Ramban here writes, V'hayosher b'ein av tase. You find this Ramban in a number of places in the Chumash, by the way. This is not the only Ramban. Ramban believes that yashar, to do what is straight in the eyes of God, refers to interpersonal relations. Ramban says, V'hayosher b'ein av tase, it doesn't mean mitzvos. It means business. It means doing things properly. Right, it means not being deceitful and treating people well. Ramban writes that what the Torah is adding on top of performance of mitzvos is being a good person. Vayashar b'ein av taseh, and that's included in it. Right, that's why. Did you read my article this week? I hope so. This past Shabbos in the newsletter. If you didn't, maybe you should. Maybe you shouldn't. I'm not telling you to. I'm not telling you it was good. I'm just saying that in there I quoted a Gemara in Kiddushin, and the Gemara in Kiddushin based on some psukim, whatever it is. You can look at it. I quoted the whole thing. The Gemara writes that it's possible, the summation, the point is, the Gemara writes that it's possible to be a tzaddik but not be tov, but not be good. The Gemara writes that those two things don't always come together. You can be righteous and bad at the same time. Conversely, you can be bad and I'm sorry, you can be good and not righteous at the same time. Meaning, I can fulfill all of the mitzvos and I can daven with tremendous intent and I can keep Shabbos meticulously, but I'll cheat people in business or I'll be mean to other people when I see them on the street. So I might be righteous, but that doesn't make me good. Right? It's not the same thing. They don't come together, and you have to work on both. We have to be good and we have to be righteous. And that's what Ramban here writes. That's what Ramban here writes. And so we should work on being good, and we should work on being righteous, and we should improve our belief in God, not only when things are great and going well, but also when things are hard and also when things are difficult. We should realize that God is tremendously near in times of danger, in times of sorrow, but that God is also tremendously near, giving us and providing for us our daily necessities, our normal everyday things, so that we should reach levels that the Jewish people did when they saw and crossed the sea, and we should not fall into the traps that they did when they reached the other side, so that we too should bring ourselves to near and close encounters with God as they would soon reach on the Mount Sinai. Everybody have a great day. Thanks a lot for coming.